Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions.
Hey, Emily, it's been a few weeks. We did mention that we were going to have some time off. Not only because I'm on holiday, but that you got COVID again, and we discussed that last time, but it's been a few weeks now. How are you doing?
So I am 4 weeks since I got my third infection of COVID. I thought I was recovering quite well. I had a week in Greece and did all right. And then I really have been feeling pretty awful the past week and a half. Obviously, you can't, if this was my first infection, you couldn't now classify this as long COVID because I'm only 4 weeks post-infection. But given that I have had long COVID now for 2.5 years, I can tell you that this is all the long COVID symptoms back, and it's really not very pleasant. I've had the absolute crushing exhaustion. I've got muscle weakness. I am having to take painkillers to get out of bed every morning. These headaches, physically and mentally, it's been really one of the worst weeks. I feel like I've gone back 9 months. None of the gains that I had made seem to have stuck. None of the things that I have been taking seem to have protected me from this fall. And then I've got other lovely things, like I seem now to have a lovely post-COVID rash, circles of welts around my armpits, and that's been there for 4 weeks.
Oh my good grief.
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
And I know Emily's just showing me her armpits on the video and she has these big red bands around them. They look really painful.
Yeah, it's really painful. And try immobilizing your armpits. It's not very easy.
What about the throat constriction? I asked because, are you taking any of the antihistamine protocol, fexofenadine and famotidine?
No, I haven't started any antihistamines, but yeah, I've got that throat constriction.
You might want to do that for your, like, your armbands.
I was thinking about this today and I thought that you were going to give me exactly that advice.
Listen, you're still smiling and it's, you know, third time lucky. Maybe this will be the one that pushes your body to get rid of it once and for all.
You know how positive I like to be, and that was kind of how I was approaching it. And interestingly, I was listening back to an old episode of ours from about a year ago. I spoke about how the falls are so much worse if you were feeling good and not expecting them. And that's exactly what I did. I tried to be really, really positive. Take it easy. I didn't go back to trying to live life at a normal pace. I did take it easy. But I was in that very positive, this third infection is going to have wiped my system clean and I'm going to be fine. But I'm not quite fine yet. Anyway, enough about me. How was your week?
The last few weeks have been a continuation of my feeling fairly normal.
Great.
So I'm hanging on to everything that's wooden at this minute, like a knocking. I don't know if you can hear that, because I've so far managed to avoid BA5, and I'm sure, you know, I've got a plane ride on my way home from the US, and then the kids are going to go back to school, so probably monkeypox is what's going to get me. But I haven't had another COVID infection, and so I've managed to keep a few weeks, I'd say a couple of months, is it? Feeling fairly normal. Well, I've been in the US for 2 months and I was feeling good for at least a month before that.
Yeah.
But I'd had a month of feeling really ill. And I wonder if I'd had a COVID infection back then and it cleared my system. I don't know. And so in all the time I've been out here, I've got one infection from a family member, but it didn't really stick. And I had one day of that kind of, I know that long COVID feeling where I'm just dragging my body through the day and my heart rate's not quite right and I'm feeling quite breathless. And I had one day where that was fairly significant, only because it is now a little less familiar.
Yeah.
So yesterday, after I think 2 years, in one day I did 20,000 steps. Walked about 5 miles.
That's fantastic.
And surfed. And today, I am finding it hard to get around, but that's my old lady body rather than my long COVID body.
Really interesting, though, to see the next couple of days if your body is actually able to handle that.
Yeah.
And just ride straight through it.
I must say that I do still take fexofenadine because I do feel allergic-y quite a lot of the time. So I don't take it every day, but I do take it. And then on some days when I'm kind of feeling like I've overeaten, you know, that sometimes the food would give me a bit of heart, chest tightness. On those days, I will take famotidine. So I'm not at all 100% normal, Noreen, pre-COVID. I am in a good space, Noreen, long-COVID version.
Which is possibly what we have to come to terms with, that this might be the rest of our life, is that understanding how you manage your set of symptoms day to day, week to week, that enables you to live life as normally as possible with your new version of normal.
How about your tinnitus? Did it come back?
Yeah, my tinnitus is really bad.
Oh, God.
I've got the pulsatile tinnitus again, and that whooshing through my head, and I've got really weird heart rate stuff. Some days my resting pulse is around 44, and then at other times I can be lying down and it's at 84. Now, you think of POTS as being really elevated heart rate, but that is quite elevated from one day to the next, that in exactly the same position there's a difference of 40. I don't know if that's part of the pulsatile tinnitus as well, but I can feel these pulses all over my body, so I don't know if that's tinnitus or heart or washes. A lot of my stuff that's come back seems to be kind of, well, I've always had neurological, but seems to be a little bit POTS type stuff.
I think the POTS things is one of the things that's the hardest to get rid of. Even for me, I'm saying how well I feel, but I still get dizzy. You know, my heart rate still does go up and down on occasion. And that's kind of the hardcore POTS symptoms.
The dizziness has been really bad in the wake of this infection.
That's one of the reasons we went back to talk to another expert in POTS, but this time someone who focuses on physical therapy as well as looking at the other things that you can do to help alleviate POTS symptoms, medications, water intake, salt intake.
Yeah.
So
this week we spoke to Dr. Tae Chung. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation and has a second appointment in the Department of Neurology at Johns Hopkins University, where he runs the POTS clinic. They have seen a big uptick in the number of people attending their clinics in the wake of COVID and long COVID.
We did talk to Satish Raj a few months ago, who gave us a very in-depth look at POTS, but it's such, again, a syndrome that it's something you can't cover with one person in one episode.
It's also so interesting the way that we have spoken to three different people about POTS, and they come at it from three different angles. So a cardiologist, a neurologist, and now Tae Chung, who approaches it with a physical medicine rehabilitation view as well as his neurology hat. So I think that just shows the breadth of it as a syndrome, much like long COVID, is that it's this multi-system thing. And that, I think, is why we can learn a lot about long COVID from the way that we look at POTS and the treatment of POTS. So you're combining two specialties that I've not previously, we've certainly not spoken to anyone that combines those two disciplines. Could you just explain that role?
I know some actually European audience, the field of physical medicine rehabilitation may not sound very familiar. It's a very unique specialty. We deal with function and disability. You know, it's a specialty based on population rather than organ system. So for example, the specialty pediatrics, they're dealing with all these kids, but not specific diseases.
Yeah.
So kind of similar to that, we deal with people with all kinds of disability, but doesn't have to be specific in the organ system. So I did my residency in physical medicine rehabilitation, but afterwards, I really wanted to focus on neuromuscular nerve and muscle. So I did my fellowship training in neurology department doing all kinds of diseases in nerve and muscle. Just like a lot of people at, you know, in big academic institutes, I focus on very small things, and I see patients basically or parts or autonomic dysfunction, or a muscle disorder called myositis.
Okay, so you're both a clinician and a researcher. So just to get this clear, you were the director of the POTS program at Johns Hopkins before COVID started. You now have a long COVID clinic at Johns Hopkins. Are the two somehow combined, or are they still run separately?
So I've been running POTS clinic for about 5 years now. But since 2020, we had a sudden increase in POTS patients out of COVID clinic. So I actually added just a few more clinic per week just to see long COVID patients. But now we are actually seeing long COVID patients / POTS and just regular POTS in our clinic. I'm not the only one in the POTS clinic. So there are a few other people and nurse practitioners. And between us, we actually have like about 3,000 visits per year. We do have a separate post-COVID clinic. And there's a huge overlap between post-COVID clinic patient population and our POTS clinic.
I was just curious as to that overlap, because this uptick in POTS from long COVID seems to be prominent. But would you say that it's more than an overlap? I think that you have said that there's a clinical suspicion that many of the characteristics of post-COVID are similar to those with POTS, or it is, your suggestion is that it is POTS.
It is POTS, yes. And I guess your question is whether the POTS patients or POTS-like symptoms as a post-COVID syndrome, is it same as regular POTS or is it different?
Yeah, I'm just trying to establish if you can separate it out. Is long COVID POTS? In some instances, is long COVID POTS?
I think that's an excellent question then, and trying to talk to other people about. Basically, both long COVID syndrome and also POTS, I think people have to understand POTS is also a clinical syndrome. It's not a single specific disease. It's actually very broadly defined at this point. Although, you know, a lot of people suspect that a large percentage of just regular POTS patients, they have those symptoms from autonomic nerve dysregulation. But still, it doesn't have to be just autonomic neuropathy. It can be a lot of other things too. And post-COVID syndrome, it's not just about all chronic fatigue and brain fog. A lot of people, for example, they develop Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a really well-known disease that can occur after any virus infections. And you can, you know, include them as having post-COVID syndrome too. So yes, to answer the question, I do think post-COVID POTS, their symptoms and clinical presentations are very typical and not really different from regular POTS. But that being said, POTS is a very broad category. And I do think actually post-COVID POTS is probably more better defined condition because it's coming out of one single pathogen.
So can you describe for us the typical symptoms of a long COVID POTS patient within the syndrome?
Absolutely. So just like regular POTS, they develop severe chronic fatigue, brain fog, especially in the beginning of the disease stage, meaning you know right after the infection. They have a lot of palpitation, orthostatic tachycardia, meaning they get kind of a little dizzy, lightheaded, and having palpitation and standing position for extended period of time. It can be just sitting up for extended period of time too. Sometimes not right away. A lot of people develop a lot of gastrointestinal symptoms a little later on, which includes chronic nausea, lack of appetite, constipation, but they can alternate with diarrhea and indigestion, acid reflux kind of stuff too. And another prominent thing about both POTS and post-COVID syndrome is exercise intolerance. A lot of people develop severe flare of all the other symptoms if they do too much on the exercise. Or some malaise kind of feeling after exercise.
It's quite debilitating for a lot of people having, you know, if you're trying to deal with your symptoms of fatigue and are being told that you need to do graded exercise in order to kind of push through. But would you recommend trying to push through fatigue, or what would you say to someone who's been told that?
Absolutely not. So this is kind of paradoxical. Exercise, in my experience, both long COVID POTS and just regular POTS patients, Exercise is actually one of the most powerful interventions for these people. They actually can get much better. But at the same time, like I said, there's an exercise intolerance or post-exercise malaise or flare. So they cannot push through exercise. If they push through it, they'll have a flare and they have a lot of setback. So it's kind of paradoxical. Exercise is good, but they cannot get exercise.
Are you saying that there is a certain level of exercise that people could do without overdoing it that would be beneficial? Or does that always just remain a paradox and it's actually that you can't do exercise? Because I know that you come to your clinic
right
with a very sort of specific physio and rehabilitation angle.
Correct, yeah. I actually have to really emphasize that it's not like the patient cannot do exercise at all. It depends on the phase and where they're at. So basically the concept principle is do exercise. In a way, it's kind of better called just rehab therapy than exercise. Because when I say exercise, a lot of people have a little different idea that they're just running a treadmill.
Yeah.
So basically the concept is you have to do some kind of cardiovascular training. That means you're kind of accelerating blood flow in your body, whatever you do, to the point where you can tolerate, but not push through the limit, okay? And over time, you can very gently push your limit over time, and eventually they'll be able to do more and more. In the beginning, a lot of my patients, they have a hard time just sitting up to do anything. So those people, we usually do just core strengthening, because we know that those aggressive core strengthening can condition them for cardiovascular training later on. So a lot of those people, we just do core strengthening on a flat position. They're just lying down and doing core strengthening. And then slowly get them to stationary bike and then go on. Usually I see a lot of clinical improvement when they get to the point where they can do stationary bike for 30 to 40 minutes, for example. That's a point where they can probably get out and walk around a little bit. But even that point, if they push through, let's say, like an hour and a half, they'll have a flare too. So it's just about when their limit is.
And how do you know when their limit is?
Well, that's actually why I work with kind of more experienced physical therapists who's been seeing all these POTS patients, because at this point, there's no clear biomarker where that point is. You just have to kind of work with the patient. It's highly individualized, and we'll try certain things and see if they can tolerate or not. Well, our team usually use heart rate response. Definitely not the best parameter for sure, but still one of the most available ones. They have a smartwatch, and then theoretically what happens is that in the beginning, for example, let's say they're doing core strengthening or some very mild cardiovascular training, as in other normal people, their heart rate slowly increase as we do cardiovascular training, because our body has increasing demands of blood flow, right? So to meet the demands, our body increase heart rate to send more blood flow. But for POTS patient, it seems like there's some kind of wall there. And when they hit the point, there's just sudden increase in heart rate. And they start having all these symptoms and they just cannot tolerate it.
And they get the symptoms there and then at the moment. So there is a sort of warning at the time that they are doing it rather than it always being the following day.
Yes, actually both. Usually there's a little sign, even if they do not perceive it, most of the times heart rate in response can predict that kind of stuff. And if they push through that, they usually have some kind of consequence the next day. But again, like I said, we usually use heart rate, but I don't think that's the best parameters out there.
Can I ask you, while we're talking about heart rate, what the difference between simple heart rate and heart rate variability? Because a lot of people are talking about HRV.
Yep.
Can you explain to me what that is and how we monitor it?
Well, in my experience on POTS patients, HRV is usually normal. HRV basically measures heart rate response, especially with the deep breathing. So we have this, one of the autonomic testing, we check heart rate continuously and have them breathe deeply. And as we breathe deeply, because there's a little increase in the chest pressure and there's a little reduced blood return to the heart And as a response, heart rate goes up to compensate for that. And then as they breathe out, it goes down. That basically kind of evaluates, we call this cardiovagal innervation, the parasympathetic nerve innervation to the heart. And there's a reflex there. Basically, our heart is responding to blood flow to the heart. And that portion is usually not compromised in POTS patients or long COVID patients that have been testing. Now, there's actually a really interesting article that came out of Dr. David Systrom in Brigham and Women's in Harvard. He actually did the same thing in POTS patients before COVID happened and recently published the data on long COVID patients. And what he does is very interesting and very, very invasive, actually. He put a central catheter and then arterial line and have them exercise so that they can see actually what's going on their blood flow in the heart and lung, which is great physiological measures, but it's probably very involved. Like, we need really brave patients to volunteer for that. And he did a fantastic job. And one of the really shocking and interesting things that a lot of POTS patients have been suspecting for a long time is that as they do more exercise, normally what happens is that our muscles also pump, okay? So our skeletal muscle pumps the blood back to the heart and it helps circulate blood much better while doing exercise, right? Because what happens, especially when you're doing cardiovascular training, is that you circulate more blood and increase blood return to heart and lung so that the heart can send more blood to the muscles and other body, right? So you expect increase in this kind of blood flow return to the heart in normal patients, but in POTS, it actually flats or decreases. So that kind of suggests that it's probably some peripheral blood vessel problem, autonomic regulation problem, meaning our peripheral body is not pumping and returning blood back to the heart enough, then there's a discrepancy there. Now, there's demanding need from the skeletal muscle, but then there's not enough blood that's pumping out of the cardiovascular system.
Would you have a hypothesis as to what's causing that in long COVID?
So my hypothesis is that probably at least some subset of long COVID POTS patient, again, this hypothesis, is that it's probably sympathetic nerve denervation. Fancy word, we call this sympathetic vasomotor dysfunction, denervation. So our sympathetic nervous system, well, it does a lot of different things. It deals with the sweating, or basically fight or flight reaction, right?
Yeah.
Sweating, anxiety, and then muscle contraction and all that. But one of the most important part of the sympathetic nerve function is that it supplies all the blood vessels and it kind of pumps the blood to the skeletal muscle so it can increase blood flow to the muscle, right? Because of part of flight, you have to run away. And there's some indirect evidence suggesting that sympathetic nerve is dysfunctional in POTS or long COVID patients. And basically, given their post-infectious nature, I suspect this is some kind of inflammatory, maybe autoimmune reaction, just like Guillain-Barré syndrome, where they have a virus infection, the virus is all gone, maybe lingering, I don't know, but I don't know the answer. I know there's a lot of controversies there. But there's probably our bodies attacking our sympathetic nervous system, just like in Guillain-Barré syndrome. But instead of Guillain-Barré syndrome attacking large fiber sensory nerve, this is probably attacking the sympathetic nerve and denervating nerve that's regulating the blood flow. And hence we have this exercise intolerance and brain fog and other things.
Is that denervation, in terms of semantics, is the denervation, is that similar to neuropathy?
Correct.
Okay. So there's a lot of talk, isn't there, of sort of neuropathy of the extremities. Do you think that your suggestion there, if our muscles are not sort of pumping blood back to the heart, that neuropathy is actually more than just in the extremities and that it's more of a neuropathy throughout all organs?
Yes. That's a great point, because a lot of people, when they say neuropathy, they're talking about numbness, tingling in their fingertips or toes. Well, there are actually so many kinds of different neuropathies, depending on what type of nerve that gets damaged and where it gets damaged. So there's like a million different kinds of neuropathies. In fact, for most long COVID patients or POTS, if you test their regular nerve, although they feel numbness, tingling in their fingertips sometimes, we don't see any we call this large fiber nerve damage, meaning the large fiber nerve is just kind of regular nerve that we can move or feel kind of stuff. We don't really see that kind of nerve damage in most POTS patients, but actually pretty good portion of our long COVID and POTS patients, we see what is called small fiber neuropathy. And basically pretty much most of our autonomic nervous systems consist of small size fiber, small fiber. And that gives some evidence towards to this autonomic neuropathy on top of the fact that small fiber usually deals with a little bit of pain and temperature perception.
Yeah, that's really interesting because small fiber neuropathy is often just used to refer to the fingertips, for example. I hadn't necessarily equated that there is also those small nerves throughout the whole system.
Right. Well, small fiber neuropathy, again, is not just one thing. It's more like pathological description that selectively small caliber fiber is affected. But again, there are so many different kinds of small fiber. Autonomic nerve fibers are pretty much all small fibers, but also sensory small fibers can get affected as well. But as you know, there's actually increasing evidence that small fiber neuropathy is found in long COVID POTS patients. They do not necessarily have this typical painful small fiber neuropathy symptoms where they present with severe burning sensation and stuff like that. They may or may not have it. But to me, what that means is that it really just suggests that some portion of small fibers get affected. My suspicion is autonomic nerve fibers.
Okay.
So I'm wondering, because there's a lot of discussion in long COVID about brain damage, and some studies have shown deposits in the brain. And I'm wondering if the system is damaged from there down, or do you think it's more of a systemic issue?
So that's a great question, actually. In the neurological world, we divide our nervous system broadly into central nervous system and peripheral nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And central nervous system is basically defined by all the nerve tissue, which is all enclosed in the skull and the vertebral column. And we divide into CNS, central nervous system, PNS, peripheral nervous system, not just because they're anatomically different, but they're physiologically very different as well. And for example, as probably some of you know, central nervous system, once it gets damaged, it doesn't regrow. I mean, now it's been challenged, but very difficult to regrow and so on. Whereas PNS, nerve actually regrows, sometimes completely, most of the times incompletely. But my suspicion is more PNS problem than CNS, because first, we actually haven't, especially for post-COVID POTS or post-COVID syndrome in general, I don't think we have a convincing evidence that shows that there's any ongoing inflammation or definitely viral particle in the central nervous system. As you know, like in the past 2-3 years, people have done a lot of CSF studies to see a lot of different markers, to see if there's any viral particles, and autopsy studies in the brain really didn't show convincingly that there's something going on in the central nervous system. And second portion is that POTS, I also in general, I think it's more peripheral nervous system problem, because while there's some evidence to suggest small fiber damage, we need to skin nerve biopsy or cutaneous nerve biopsy. We sometimes look at see small fiber damage, but we also look at sweat gland innervation problem. So sweat gland innervation damage. And that sweat gland actually comes exactly from the same peripheral nerve ganglia, like the cell bodies. And that same cell body actually sends out the axons to the same blood vessels as well. So because there's no direct way to evaluate the blood vessel nerve innervation, we usually look at the sweat gland innervation along with the small fiber innervation. And we actually see quite a bit sweat gland denervation as well. So that's one evidence of peripheral nerve damage there. And secondly, all these kind of fight or flight reactions that POTS patients or long COVID patients experience, such as tachycardia, anxiety, sleeping problems, or gastrointestinal problems, are thought to be coming from abnormal compensatory mechanisms coming from central nervous system, meaning the whole central reflex arc in the brain, the brain stem in general, is thought to be intact or exaggerated. So that's why it goes back to heart rate variability question, whether it's abnormal or normal. We actually see not only is normal, they're sometimes exaggerated, meaning they're kind of overcompensating it. And brain is now activating in the central nervous system, they're activating sympathetic nervous system to compensate for that. And hence, they have tachycardia. So tachycardia pause is actually not a bad thing all the time. It somehow actually helps people. That's why a lot of POTS patients, you know, they feel dizzy or lightheaded, but they don't completely pass out all the time. And also, sometimes they pass out, but they wake up right away because now they have a tachycardia, and now it's increasing cardiac output, right? But the problem is now they have a lot of adrenaline symptoms, fight or flight symptoms that's making them very miserable. They can't sleep. They can't really digest food. They lose appetite. And anxious, just a little anxiety, a little different anxiety than just depression anxiety. It's just physical anxiety.
Yeah, it's very physical.
Light sensitivity, sound sensitivity kind of stuff too. And that's also pretty debilitating at the same time. So that's why I said it's paradoxical. I think POTS in general is a very paradoxical disease because you, one hand, you have a sympathetic nerve not working and not regulating the blood flow. On the other hand, we have too much sympathetic chemicals that's overflowing and causing all the problem.
Yeah.
Paradoxical problem. And exercise as well, it's paradoxical. Exercise is very helpful, but you can't tolerate the exercise.
One of the things that is discussed both with people who suspect they have POTS and within the long COVID community is diagnosis of POTS. And I would really like it if you could explain the way in which you diagnose POTS. And if you can talk to us a little about the tilt test, because there are a lot of people who would consider themselves to have all of the POTS symptoms who don't pass the tilt test. Do you diagnose purely on the basis of a test, or does the patient's history and presentation take quite a considerable role in your diagnosis as well?
Well, both, everything, not just tilt table test for sure, because like in medical conditions in general, but specifically any neurological diagnosis, you don't just rely on one single test. And probably most importantly, clinical presentation is very important. How they develop symptoms and how they present it, how those symptoms evolve. That's actually one critical thing.
Yeah.
Tilt table test, I think, is a one piece of whole puzzle. I kind of heard podcast episode with Dr. Tish Raj as well, is that, you know, everybody knows that actually in tilt table test for POTS, they sometimes meet the criteria, but the next time they repeat the tilt table, they may or may not. So, but I know some doctors, they just stick to this hard criteria. Okay, now today you don't have POTS because you didn't meet, your heart rate only increased by 20, but then next month you increased by 50. So now you have POTS. Well, I mean, that's probably one approach there because the definition of POTS really didn't define how many times you have to meet the criteria, right? But as with a lot of neurological conditions and diagnosis, I think it's important to look at the big picture and have a little bit of kind of a proposed pathophysiology behind it. Because at the end of the day, whether this is autonomic dysfunction, nerve denervation, neuropathy, or some endocrinological problem, at the end of the day, when you say POTS, it's not only just about heart rate going up, it's more about blood flow dysregulation, right? So the heart rate, orthostatic tachycardia, is basically our body's response to perceived blood loss in different positions, right? But in fact, they're not actually bleeding, right? We have to make sure that their heart is normal and they're not actually actively bleeding, right? And based on that, that really means that it's either endocrinological regulation problem or autonomic nerve dysregulation problem, right? So to me, well, clinical presentation, I think, is really most important to make sure, first, you rule out other things that can mimic those conditions, like, for example, heart failure or some other, you know, neurological MS or something else, and make sure that their heart muscle itself are normal. And then a tilt table test shows kind of a signs that are consistent with this blood flow dysregulation. And if that's not clear, I oftentimes do further autonomic testing with the heart rate variability and Valsalva testing, and also what is called skin biopsy to look at the small fiber denervation and focal denervation as well. So I'm going to have to say that diagnosis is based on a lot of different things and some exclusion and inclusion, but for autonomic nervous system, currently there are not many great tools to really pinpoint all the autonomic nerve function. So That's why there's a whole lot of other difficulties out there.
It's a bit of a picture in long COVID, isn't it? That we have various tests or blood markers or physical testing, and then nothing shows up. And so it's actually just down to the physician's clinical diagnosis.
Okay, a couple of things, actually. First of all, to that point, like nothing shows up as, you know, abnormal. Well, we shouldn't be frustrating anybody, to be honest, because one thing that I want to tell you is that one of the reasons why POTS became a thing after long COVID is that for a lot of other doctors who've never seen POTS patients, it may sound very random, nonspecific, and just mysterious. But for people like us who's been, you know, seeing a lot of POTS patients, it's very characteristic. So I want to actually emphasize that there are some people who might need like to do a lot of workups, MRIs everywhere and all the, you know, crazy workups. But, you know, a lot of people who've seen, let's say if you guys come to my clinic and see like 20, 30 POTS patients, and you kind of get a sense how it's different. However, I know there's a lot of money going on for long COVID research and all that, but I can tell you where it's not going to is that there's no financial incentive for any doctors these days, whether it's Europe or America, to spend a lot of time with the patients and listen to them. And then if they do, actually, the pattern is pretty clear. They have this kind of blood flow-like symptoms and also adrenaline symptoms, and it becomes very typical. For most cases, they're young, otherwise they were healthy and suddenly develop these symptoms. I'm just going to say, yeah, of course, it's much easier if you find clear kind of blood marker where you get the test, you have a long COVID or not. They'd be fantastic for patients and doctors. But a thing that I want to emphasize, just listen to the patients and you will probably catch quite a bit of their characteristic symptoms.
So for me, for example, I have much more of the POTS symptoms than Emily to do with cardiac. So I know that you said you listened to our episode with Dr. Satish Raj. But so when I stand up, my heart rate will go very high, or when I go upstairs, but then it will reduce very quickly. But I will have that abnormal heart rate increase. But then I know that traditional POTS, my heart rate should stay elevated for longer. And the other thing that I've been looking at, because I have a smartwatch, is the heart rate variability. And it's actually pretty reduced for someone my age, my previous level of fitness. And there's something happening, obviously, but I don't fit the traditional POTS model. And this is all post-COVID.
So the first point about the heart rate sustainability is that, yeah, that's true. For example, when you do tilt table test, heart rate should sustain for, you know, good amount of time. What is a good amount of time? Nobody knows. There's actually not even a normative studies where, okay, why 30 BPM increase or 40 BPM increase? Has anybody done like all just a bunch of normal healthy people and how much they increase or not? Actually, I looked it up and there's nothing there, actually. Somewhat arbitrary, to be honest. I mean, I'm running POTS clinic, obviously, but do I love this name? I don't love this definition, to be honest, because I don't think it's a great name. I don't think it catches all good pathophysiology. But I love the fact that somebody came up with this name, because it used to be that these people are all dismissed of being just, you know, crazy and faking illness or something. But I'm glad that they put the name so we kind of capture. It's kind of close enough to suspect some kind of dysautonomia or blood flow regulation problem. But at the same time, the whole definition has created a lot of confusion and controversies, which kind of impeded some better research.
So actually, you're saying that you don't have to necessarily fulfill the very specific but slightly hazily drawn up criteria to be treated by someone like you who has experience with a syndrome that encompasses a wide range of long COVID symptoms. Is that your suggestion?
Well, that's true. But generally speaking, what a lot of people in my experience, whether it's post-COVID or POTS, is that usually in the beginning of the disease stage, a lot of times, I mean, some people, they have these POTS symptoms since young childhood that they don't remember exactly when they have it. A lot of actual patients, they kind of remember when they start having those symptoms. And it's usually acute onset after some kind of viral or bacterial infections. And usually in the beginning, maybe let's say the first couple of years or so, that's when you see a lot of tachycardia response. But usually it looks like as the disease progresses, either their heart rate response gets not as dramatic. Instead, their blood pressure tends to go up a little higher. And or a lot of patients don't even perceive that palpitation. So I have a patient who's walking and we check the heart rate. Her heart rate went up like 130 and 120. She didn't even realize that her heart rate is that fast. She just felt a little uncomfortable, but you know, she didn't realize it. But in the beginning, they do realize that they feel like they're going to die because their heart rate going 130. And if I have a 130, like I know that. I think it also depends on the disease stage and maturity. And post-COVID just happened 2020, 2021. So I think a lot of people are now talking about POTS because now they're experiencing this tachycardia. But eventually it may change the phenotype a little bit over time.
So is that an improvement or is that worse because now you have high blood pressure or hypertension?
Well, to me, I don't think it's necessarily improvement because as long as the patients are suffering from symptoms, it's not an improvement.
Right.
It's just a different, you know, compensation from the body. That's how I say it.
So how do you approach, I'm not asking you to treat all of us, but how do you approach the treatment and rehabilitation of patients with long COVID pods? Because I know that you're quite keen on using non-pharmacological intervention as well as potentially medication, but you are interested in trying to treat them with physiotherapy and rehabilitation, which in this country particularly has had a fairly damning response to it. So people say how they were just offered physio or just offered some kind of rehab, and they don't believe that that is the route to getting well from long COVID. Tell me about your approach.
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. And well, the simple answer is that this requires a huge team approach. It's not just single physiotherapy or one or two drugs. It really requires a team approach. Now, before I say that, the rationale is that I give this analogy to everybody, my patients. So imagine yourself as a water balloon that's attached to a pump. So basically, it's a pump failure. Normal people, we stand up, the pump squeeze the balloon so it doesn't collapse. Basically, it's a pump failure. That's, you know, it's like oversimplifying all the problem now. So you can think about two approaches where try to fix the pump, which we are not there yet, right? And then we can do something about the balloon. Now, so imagine filling the balloon with the water and expand the balloon. What happens? It can build up pressure. So even though pump is not perfectly fixed, it's not going to collapse and can, you know, address some problems, right? So we call this volume expansion therapy. And that's actually one of the reasons why you heard if you have a POTS, drink a lot of water and salt.
Yeah, that's something that Satish Raj was explaining to us as well, the water and salt to increase your blood volume.
Exactly. The target is to increase blood volume. But again, the drinking water is not the only way to achieve there. There are certain medications that can retain the fluid to help with that. Patients who are debilitated, I give just IV saline bolus to when they have a flare, and all combination of so-called lifestyle modification to, you know, increase salt in their diet and so on. And actually, I see exercise as a part of volume expansion therapy because the whole goal, why exercise works, nobody really knows at this point. But my theory is that, you know, cardiovascular training increases blood volume for anybody. When you do cardiovascular training, what happens? Our body makes more red blood cells because they have to deliver more oxygen. And that red blood cells take up quite a bit of volume, and that expands blood volume significantly, probably more significantly than any drugs that you can think about. That's why I think exercise is probably one of the most powerful interventions that we have. But again, we talked about the whole challenges to get there. Everything has to be kind of more, I actually look at it as more a stepwise approach. They need to start drinking water and sodium first, and change your lifestyle and preserve their energy during their day. So it's a team approach. I don't really start the physical therapy unless I'm pretty convinced that they're drinking enough water and doing something to increase their hydration. I still try to start PT early enough that they can start somewhere because it takes a long time to build that up to get to that point. Usually more than, like I tell my patients that just be prepared, it's going to probably take more than several months and typically more than a year to get there. Those persistence is a key. Not a lot of patients have resource to continue their PT or all the treatment, but that's the goal. And as they go on PT, let's say, for example, they develop flares, I may just give some IV saline infusion or some drugs to help with the volume expansion. So as you can imagine, this is more kind of stepwise approach, and everybody should get involved in there. MDs, nurses. We don't have nutrition, unfortunately, at this point, but if you have a nutritional dietitian, they can play an important role. Psychologists can play an important role in managing their stress reduction, mindfulness, and decreasing their fight or flight symptoms too. And as I said, physiotherapists play a crucial role in all this volume expansion. So it's easier to be said than done, but I can tell you it's really well done. It can be very effective. Now, fundamentally, kind of, which is my focus and research, is to really try to fix the pump. And basically, it's just to try to treat this inflammatory neuropathy to that specific sympathetic nervous system. And I'm actually starting a clinical trial, phase two, on one of the immune drugs. Basically, the idea is to manipulate the immune system and then stop the inflammation. And I do think that's going to be very promising therapy.
Which drug are you looking at?
It's a drug that can reduce the antibody level in general. Once we are ready, actually, I can post it on our website, but I don't think I'm allowed to see the specific name of the drug.
It's a drug currently in existence, currently being used, or it's a drug in development?
It's recently approved for another disease called myasthenia gravis. So it is recently being developed for certain indications.
And it's gone through various stages of clinical trials in the treatment of that?
Yes, correct.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting, actually.
That's very exciting.
It's a clinical trial, so we don't know if it's going to work or not. But at least conceptually it makes more sense to me. I mean, not just this drug. I have some other drugs that I'm kind of discussing with various agents to try to start on those clinical trials and those long COVID PATH patients here too. So the good news is that before COVID, I've been just talking about the volume expansion, but I couldn't really talk too much about other approach, but it's a very debilitating condition that affects too many people now. So I think there are some opportunities out there.
That's fascinating. We would love to know more about your study into this drug or any other drugs that you start to look at. But is it with the view that you're actually trying to redress something, trying to change something, rather than something that is just that people take long term, that's just another sort of suppressant?
Again, like treating the balloon, again, like I'm going to emphasize that this is actually, it can be very effective. I've actually used some other available immune drugs on these people, a couple of long COVID, but a lot more on PATH patients with pretty good benefits in there too. They get significantly better, which is one of the reasons that I think is an autoimmune condition.
Yeah.
But still, even those people who are getting immune drugs got better, they still need to drink a lot of water, and exercise still provide additional benefits to them. So I just want to emphasize, it's not like they can forget about drinking water and exercise and modification. It's combination. But still, it's very powerful tool, right? Because it's addressing more pathology.
So you're actually going after the mechanism for the disease or the syndrome rather than just trying to treat the symptoms, which is always something that Emily and I both like to hear, because that's very exciting, because then, there's hope to be fixed, right?
Oh, yeah, it is very exciting.
We spoke to someone, they were talking about an IL-6 inhibitor, using the same kind of autoimmune drug in a similar way. So I wonder if you ever tried anything like that on your POTS patients?
I haven't tried IL-6 inhibitors, just from kind of my experience on POTS, autoimmune POTS. Generally, I've used some other different, class of immune drugs that didn't really work. I think the class of drug that deals with autoantibody usually works better, in my experience. So that's why I'm more interested in this particular drug.
And those are different to the immunosuppressants that are currently used for various autoimmune conditions. The drug that you're proposing is not currently used.
Well, it's recently approved for myasthenia gravis, so it is, being used. So let's say if it works, but suggest that this is probably autoimmune disease. But let's say if this is work, does it prove that it's an autonomic nerve inflammation or not? We don't know. It's kind of agnostic approach. We're just manipulating their immune system. So it may be some other inflammation somewhere else, which is kind of another project that I'm kind of working on, is to find the autoimmune marker from their blood so that, again, you know, kind of goal is to have a clear blood marker that shows not only this is long COVID path, but also you have the disease, right?
And how far are you down that path of trying to find a marker?
Yeah, not enough data to say I have results. I do what is called translational science, where I take patients' blood samples or work on the patients, but then bring sometimes their samples to the lab, sometimes using the mice. So I go back and forth between bench lab and clinical research. And we're at the point where we are kind of like technically just trying to filter in some portion of the blood when it comes to research work. There's so many thousand different steps to be done before, you know, we get there. So it's hard to answer the question, how far am I? Hopefully very close, but...
So why did you choose this drug? What's the similarity between this and myasthenia gravis?
Basically, I've used IVIG. It's an immunoglobulin, and it's actually kind of transfusion. They collect immunoglobulin from people, and then higher dose of IVIG has what is called immunomodulatory effect, meaning the idea is that it kind of binds to all these autoreactive antibodies and then precipitates it. So kind of clearing all these antibodies so that they stop inflaming the tissues. And I've used IVIG on those POTS patients, a couple of long COVID POTS patients, with great results. Then why am I not using this IVIG on all these people? Because at least in America, the insurance is not going to prove that. I think those couple of patients are very lucky to get the insurance approved. But most people, I just get denied. Simple. And it's extremely expensive, and it relies on other people's transfusion donation, blood donation, and so on. But there are actually multiple drugs that's developing at this point that conceptually works similarly. It doesn't work similarly at all with IVIG, but conceptually very similar in that there are multiple classes of medication that brings down antibodies in general in our human body. And this is one of those drugs. And that's why I chose this particular drug. The class of drug is called FcRn receptor antagonist. And there are a lot of different drugs that are under development, and I cannot tell you the exact name and company at this point because we are under contract now. But soon we'll be advertising it, and it's a multiple site. Hopkins is definitely the originating site, but we have other collaborators who's going to be recruiting. So small study phase two at this point. And personally, I think it's going to work, and we can hopefully move on to phase three, and it eventually becomes available.
Would you like to tell us, with your current treatment strategies, how much success have you had? Have you successfully ridded people of long COVID POTS?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define success. So my immediate goal for any long COVID POTS or just regular POTS patients is I'm actually wearing rehab doctor hat. And my immediate goal is to get them to a little more function. As you know, most of these people are completely debilitated. And most people, they stop going to work or school. And even if they do, they somehow have to modify their work environment. They just can't do it. It's so debilitating. My immediate goal is to get them to close to function, whatever I do. It can be just combination. It can be just volume expansion. They get better. They can go back. Or even, again, like as a rehab doctor, I do some other, you know, maybe I can just give them a wheelchair or something, so that they can participate in their function, you know, daily life even better. That I see as a part of our treatment too. So I don't have a statistics, because again, it depends on how you define success.
Yeah.
But I think, especially when the volume expansion is well done, most people have some relief in the symptoms to the point where they can do something a little more than before. But, you know, really have to be aggressive and, you know, again, it's a team approach, not just in the sense that we need MDs and therapists and nurses. Also, the patient is probably the most important part of the team, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who have to really do something together. We're kind of like, I see that as a kind of training. We are the coach, and patients are actually the player. So, you know, players have to really play. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of hard to get successful.
Well, it sounds like you're doing excellent work and helping people. But I think we're very excited by the idea of your study into the drug, because I think at the end of the day, we all want to be a little bit better as long COVID patients. But what we want more than anything is to not have long COVID anymore, I think.
Exactly. No, I completely agree with you. It's the idea to get rid of all that, for sure.
Like you've just said, though, it is really hard work trying to manage this disease.
Oh, no.
For you, but and for us.
Yeah. I mean, well, I don't have POTS myself, but I've been seeing a lot of POTS patients, and I just have some glimpse of ideas what kind of they're going through. It's extremely hard and debilitating. That's why, I opened the POTS clinic. I think, not that I'm happy that a lot of people get long COVID at all, but at the same time, it's providing some opportunities for POTS patients.
Yeah.
Even before.
We agree.
Right?
It's providing an opportunity in lots of areas of medicine that have been neglected, like ME-CFS and POTS and all these kind of syndromes that doctors don't want to deal with because it's too difficult. It's such a advantage and horrible statistic that there's so many long COVID patients now.
Correct.
I mean, I just want to emphasize right at the end here before we say goodbye that throughout the interview you have talked about the importance of exercise. But you've also qualified that with this idea, well, you haven't said the word, of pacing, right? So you must pace. You only work to a certain level, then you pace and you pace and you pace, and that's how you expect to get some improvement, rather than this idea of graded exercise therapy, which has become a dirty phrase amongst long COVID patients because it does induce post-exertional malaise and makes them feel very bad. But it's important just to say that you are saying that exercise is important, but you need to pace.
Yeah, pace is another good word. I think just saying exercise probably confuses people too. It's not like, exercise in the sense that running in a treadmill. It's more like rehab and some kind of special physical activities.
Yeah. Well, we will direct people to your website. And thank you so much.
Don't you feel that all of the different people we speak to are now becoming more based in different camps? So we have these team microclots. There is now this much stronger autoimmune group of voices emerging. And we do actually seem to be progressing in both of those. But in the autoimmune, there does actually seem to be so much work going into looking at whether it is affecting us.
I was just saying to you before we started the recording today that I do find it fascinating that someone can look down a microscope and tell me that my natural killer cells are in the toilet.
Yeah.
And my CD4 and my CD8 cells are also in the toilet. And then my doctor tell me that it's all fine and know that there is actually a problem. And an immunologist will tell me, yes, there is a problem.
Yeah. What's really interesting to me about that is whether we can... I mean, autoimmune conditions are lifelong. Is this going to help us find some way of treating autoimmune conditions so people actually recover?
Yeah, in much the same way that we talk about the ME-CFS community as being brothers and sisters in arms, I feel that the autoimmune community is the same and that we should all be seeing rheumatologists.
Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.